brought to you by SOCOM Athlete. Cindy.
Becoming a special tactics officer is not for just anyone. It takes a certain kind of person. I became a STO because I wanted to do something that was consequential to the defense of the nation. Every day I come to work, I find myself pushing beyond what I thought I was capable of. But once you get there, you'll come back to me and you'll say, "I know what you mean."
Thanks for tuning in to SOCOM Athletes Podcast, Send Me. This is your host, Jason Sweet, and I'm on with another very special guest tonight, Chris Walsh. He is a special tactics officer and a special warfare officer who is actually now a USA bobsled team member, and he actually does this full time while still being an active duty Air Force member. So what's going on, Chris? Thanks for joining us on the podcast tonight, my man.
Hey, Jason. I appreciate it. Thanks for having me. I'm looking forward to this.
Where are you talking to us from, Chris?
I live out in Southern Pines, North Carolina right now. So I was stationed out here with one of the special tactics units, and so transitioned out of that into the Air Force's athlete program while I was here.
And Chris, how long have you been in the Air Force now?
Coming up on 11 years. So yeah, here in June, I think I roll over the 11 year mark.
And how long does it typically take to pin on major?
I put on last year, so about full 10 years, I think, is right about the mark when you pin it. I think I was a select around 9 years, I want to believe, is when you meet the board and all that fancy stuff. So, yeah. Well,
congratulations, Chris. That's a huge rank, man. Big milestone from captain to major. So let's rewind a little bit, Chris. Tell us a little bit about you whenever you were a kid. Did you know about being a special tactics officer? Did you know about Navy SEALs? Did you know about special ops? Or was this something that you found out about later on in life?
Yeah, I did, actually. And I've actually kind of, this is something I've been wanting to do for a long time, since I was probably a kid. I think seeing Top Gun, the movie that got me into like wanting to be around the military, was Top Gun and Tom Cruise. And, you know, growing up around that time frame when that came out, and then Charlie Sheen's Navy SEALs was like the first like special operations movie I ever came across. And then
Charlie Sheen,
I grew up in North.
So you're a Charlie Sheen fan, yeah. Chris? Woo.
I think
we all were at that time, right? At that time.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then the diehards maybe still are.
Yeah. So, grew up in North Carolina, and both my folks are actually enlisted Air Force, which is kind of a funny dynamic we have in the family. But like my dad's a master sergeant, and my mom is—they're both reservists for a long time. But she's a master sergeant as well. And so I, growing up, them going to Pope for their like reserve duty, I would go down there and kind of got exposed to. It's a big soft, you know, Fort Bragg. Pope is a big soft hub, and they had some friends that worked in those communities, and I just kind of got exposed to it early.
So Chris, rewind real quick. Both of your parents are enlisted in the Air Force, and you are an officer. So obviously our dad's always going to be our dad. Mom's always going to be our mom, right? We always respect them. But what's it like to get saluted by your parents?
It's kind of cool in a lot of ways. Like, one of the traditions when you commission as an officer is you get a silver dollar, and the first enlisted member that salutes you, you're supposed to hand that silver dollar to. So it was kind of cool to like have that scenario play out between me and my dad. Cause that's, you know, being able to do something like that with your father is a pretty neat thing, and kind of walk in his shoes. And I got to do a lot of their re-enlistments, like their final ones for their careers. So that was, you know, those are cool moments that you don't really get to have without having that dynamic.
That's awesome.
I was really, really cool.
Great, man. So, I mean, you had known about the military your entire life. I mean, you had military lineage, you got military blood. You knew you wanted to do this. What did your parents think about it? Because I know, like, as a parent, you kind of think about like, oh, my kids are going to be in danger. Maybe I want to shield my kids. What do you think their thoughts were like on you, their son, going in and doing a dangerous job? they probably didn't have a choice, huh?
Yeah, really.
You're going to do what you're going to do, right? Personality types like you know, these kind of guys. We're going to do it, right?
So. Yeah. My dad never really pushed back on it, I think. He just wanted me to make the most informed decision that I could and make sure I knew exactly what I wanted and I didn't go down the wrong road because of some, you know, some misconception. And then my mom has never been okay with it, even to this day. So
that's just moms, man.
I don't think you'll ever get away from that.
So you go to college, right? Did you commission right after you graduated college? Like, were you a ROTC guy? Did you go to the academy? What did you do, Chris?
Yeah, I did ROTC up at Valparaiso University. Like, we were cross-towned with Notre Dame. So technically, my ROTC stuff happened at Notre Dame, but I didn't get my degree from there. So can't claim that as my alma mater. But that's how I went through it. And it was I like that route because you got to have the college experience and still, you know, work your way towards the goal of being a military officer, which is kind of cool.
So how did you feel? Was it challenging to balance college life, academics, and social life in college, trying to get that experience all together while still being an ROTC cadet, being a very time-consuming endeavor?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's a good thing because you're going to need time management as a skill when you get out into the big show in the military and whatever job you end up doing. It's going to be a crucial skill as an officer, really for anyone. It's kind of across all ranks, but it was tough for me at first. I can't say I did it right away. I struggled, but being an athlete, being ROTC, I had a lot of things going on, but it was nice. I liked it because it kept you busy and I guess kept you out of trouble from doing stuff you shouldn't be doing because I'm busy doing, you know, focusing on training or having some sort of ROTC commitment or, you know, obviously school's always there. So
now, Chris, after you commissioned, did you go straight into the phase two process and the combat control pipeline, or did you have another job?
No, I didn't. I actually commissioned as an aircraft maintenance officer. Though I wanted to do special tactics in school and I applied for special tactics in school, I didn't get through phase one. And that was a big learning experience for me, a big letdown. And really, I think a catalyst, like that moment, if had not happened, probably wouldn't have propelled me on the trajectory that I'm on now. I think that like failures like that sometimes can be really, really important if taken the right way. So that was important.
So that moment, Chris, was a big pivot point for you.
Absolutely.
Is whenever you failed at that event, that was when you knew like, okay, like here's what I need to do and I'm going to do what it takes to get there. Can you talk a little bit about what you were lacking there and what you felt maybe you needed to develop?
Absolutely. Yeah. So I mean, being an athlete in school, it wasn't so much the physical aspect. I think I was squared away there for the most part. The thing that I was lacking is I think there was a maturity level and there's some attention to detail things with like my application and the way I presented myself. I just needed time leading people in a real world scenario, like on job in the Air Force, to understand what that meant and what servant leadership meant and to figure out how to pull those qualities that I think were there all the time, but to kind of get them to grow in a way that was going to be important for me to be successful as a STO. So, and that was some of the feedback that I got like directly from the STO that talked to me because I called and asked why I didn't get through phase one because I wanted to know. They don't normally give you the info, but that, yeah, you know, this STO is pretty cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is good. I always tell people, like, always search that out. And if you, good feedback is important. Even if it's not what you want to hear, you need to hear it. And that could be the difference between you progressing to what you want to do and not. And so that feedback was, hey, you need to go out there and get some experience and lead and learn how to be that type of leader. And then you can come back and try again.
Right. And so what was the actual job that you ended up doing, Chris? And what do you feel that during that job that you lacked and that you were able to develop in particular?
So I went in and did, aircraft maintenance is very wide ranging. So you could be on any airframe as an officer. The difference is you're not like a technically, I wouldn't call you a maintainer. Like you don't know how to fix airplanes. That's not your role at all as an officer, which is kind of a letdown because I'm a hands-on type of person. But the thing it does teach you is like you get handed a whole lot of people at a very young age. Like you're 21 years old, 22 years old coming out of college. And it's like, hey, welcome to the squadron. Here's 170 guys and gals that you have a lot of responsibility over. It's not like a corporate job where you're just worried about what they're doing from 9 to 5. Like, you've got every aspect of their life is somewhat important to you and how that's going for them. So learning what that meant and understanding, like, those guys are the important part of your job. Like, that's what all that really matters is taking care of them and ensuring that the mission gets done. Those two things is what maintenance taught me, because I was forced to step up a very early stage. And so that was huge. And that, those lessons definitely were, I remember getting feedback after stow selection, and those things were things that I exemplified there that some of the guys that came straight out of the academy didn't have, because they hadn't experienced that yet. So that was, for me, a big help to get selected at phase two. So
Chris, I heard two important things there, and that was taking care of your guys and getting the mission done. And that's what you developed essentially, and it took you a little bit of time, but you got it. How long exactly did it take before you were able to get your package blessed and get your second shot?
It was an uphill battle. I will say that anyone that goes that route, you just don't know. It's going to be commanders and personalities are all, and timing is all important on what it means to cross train in the military. So those things didn't work out for me initially. I actually didn't even get a chance to apply for phase two until like my second year I was in. And then at that point, I couldn't get the career field, maintenance career field, to release me to even go do the training. But luckily, I just had the right commander show up, and he was a previous AFSOC maintenance officer and always wanted to be a stow, but it just didn't work out for him. And instead of squashing dreams, he was there to open them up. So he let me go without that release from the career field anyways, knowing that maybe if I made it, I would have a little bit more leverage. And so all in all, I mean, it probably took, it was like 2 years between getting my package in, getting into phase two, and then even after getting accepted, it took a whole nother year before the Air Force was willing to let me actually begin training. Not a short process.
It's such a valuable topic of discussion, because regardless of whether you're commissioned or you're enlisted, if you are prior service and you are trying to go into a special warfare career field, your chain of command has to bless your passage into it. And typically these type of personnel are highly motivated, highly capable personnel that are adding a valuable asset to their team now. So you, your commander and your supervisors are in a tough position, because they want to take care of you and they want to take care of the Air Force. And they want to bless what you want. They want you to be happy, but at the same time, they have to make sure that their team is taken care of. So it's a waiting game, right? You're sitting here waiting on these people to essentially bless your dreams and your goals. So eventually you said somebody came in and he was a former AFSOC commander and he took care of you. So that's pretty awesome. And you got to go back. So talk to us a little bit about whenever you came back. Were you ready to rock and roll? I bet you were pretty antsy.
Yeah, I just had to stay ready. I would say everybody who does this, even when you're in the career field, like, you never know when your moment's going to come, I think, and like when you're going to get your shot to go do what you want to do or whatever happens. Like, I was really excited to get started, and the pipeline is a long process by itself. So as you know, like, it's a couple years in most cases. So just to get going was huge. And as a stow, like, another thing that's important to know is, like, you're on a timeline, really. Like, you're going to be progressing through ranks, and that those ranks are going to bring different levels of responsibility and different experiences. And you want to kind of see all those things so you can get like time on the team. And then before you have to go do, you know, operations work or command and control stuff. So getting in as early as possible is, I think, a huge thing. It helps. It's not the end all be all. You can be successful either way, but I think it's the way to go. Like, try to get, being on the team as a stow, it just, that's the best job you're going to have, I think. And I think almost every guy would echo that sentiment, because you're so close to the dudes, and that's what it's all about, really. So.
And Chris, can you tell us a little bit about what a special tactics officer stow is?
Yeah. So, this is kind of an evolving process right now, but we're going through some changes. But as it stands, stow is still in charge of all special warfare career fields. So at a special tactics unit, you'll have PJs, you'll have CCTs, you'll have special reconnaissance now, I believe it is. It used to be SAL-T when I was still on team. But and you'll have TAC-Ps.
Or so it's soft not necessarily as part of your, safe your, to say your, that you're a combat control officer. you are a special tactics officer. Yeah. And although you may have a similar mission statement, being an air traffic controller and a JTAC as a combat controller, you are still a special tactics officer, which encompasses a broad spectrum of command and control over enlisted special warfare operators, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. The only thing that I think is the most similar is the training pipeline. When I went through it, my training pipeline, almost identical, actually mirrored almost every step of the way with the combat control training pipeline. And now I had SAUTs and other things mixed in there throughout different schools, but in terms of what trainings we hit and what events we went through, those were almost identical. But what your job really is on after all that training is done is not necessarily just what a combat controller does. That's just probably what you're the most familiar with. Like I don't know necessarily, like, I don't have the same skill set like a crow would in terms of knowing the rescue community as well, because that's their specific training. But you're still going to have PJ, so you have to learn it to some degree, because you're going to need to know how to use those guys and make their lives good for them.
And what would be the special tactics officer's role on the battlefield?
So, you know, it's going to depend on the mission. Like, we've had special tactics officers deploy as individuals, as JTACs, early. It's not so common right now, but back in, you know, the early war and global war on terror, I guess, back in Iraq, Afghanistan, guys were going out as individuals because we needed that. That's what the world needed, and that's what the U.S. needed, and we just were short on JTACs. But now, I think the way we're training guys and the expectation is you need to learn how to be a ground force commander is what we're looking for, in the sense that you need to be able to command and control troops at a tactical level, doing the missions that special tactics does. Not necessarily like, you know, you don't necessarily need to be like an assault commander. Like, that's a different scenario altogether, but you need to know your mission really well, and you need to know command and control and all the aspects of what that means. Cause you're not going to be the guy always that's like doing whatever's happening. Like, you have another, you're the up and out, as I think, as most people would say. Like, you're focused on paying attention to everything going on around you, not so much the specific task at hand.
And Chris, quick question. Some of our listeners are active duty and are versed on some of these acronyms, but some of them are younger and don't know too much about some of these things. Can you talk about the difference between an air traffic controller and a joint terminal attack controller? So ATC versus JTAC. And the importance of a combat controller / STOW having those capabilities.
Absolutely. So ATC purely is, you know, the FAA, the Federal Aviation Administration, I think is what it stands for. That's like the global universal expectations on how you manage air traffic. And so that's what you learn, is how to do air traffic control from, you know, a tower perspective, which would be like watching airplanes and talking to them that are, you know, mostly within visible line of sight. And so nothing kinetic about that in the sense that there's no bombs or anything. You're just getting good at managing air traffic, and you could run an airfield, because that's a skill set that no one else in SOF has. And that's something that like a combat controller and a STOW is very unique and we own, because it takes a while to get it. The difference with a JTAC is a qualification, right? So it's not necessary. It's not part of our pipeline initially. Like, you don't need to be a JTAC to become a STOW or a combat controller, but it's a qualification that the Army guys get. There's Navy guys who have it. So it's not exclusive to the Air Force. We are just, I think we're hands down the best at it, in my opinion, because we have such good airspace awareness because we're air traffic controllers. The two things make a lot of sense. And when you're doing that JTAC mission and you're dropping bombs in close proximity and you have 10 or 15 aircraft talking to you at one time, and they're all in different parts of airspace, you understand what that 3D picture looks like versus someone else who didn't get that background information and through ATC, and an Army guy might struggle with some of the bigger picture stuff there, you know, as an example. Not to say they can't be good JTACs. I'm not talking bad about our brothers there, but
of course.
Better than them, for sure.
Hey, it's all about being a competitor. I mean, if you don't think that you're the best, you're doing something wrong, or at least strive to be the best, so...
Yeah.
All right, Chris. So as far as your career personally, you went through the pipeline as a special tactics officer, and this is very similar to the combat control pipeline, and it's tough. It's a very high attrition rate. Combat diver, Halo school, air traffic control school is a real kick in the butt. A lot of smoke sessions, getting crushed calisthenics all day while learning a very tough trade. Can you tell us about maybe your toughest time in the pipeline and how you dealt with it?
I would say like there's two moments I can remember that were like where I honestly was like, this is incredible. This is really hard. When I first went to Stowe Selection, the very first day, you know, you'll take a PT test normally, and then you'll roll into just getting smoked. And
what was the
while
PT
I
test?
Was prepared, was like I had no idea.
1500 meter.
Yeah. At the time, that's what it was. 3 mile run, a minute of pull-ups, 2 minutes of push-ups, 2 minutes of sit-ups, and the 1500 meter swim. And then I think there are a couple underwaters as well, which are the easiest thing when you look back at all that. But but after that, you roll straight into some smoke sessions. At least that's how it worked. It's not always the same. But I was just kind of taken aback at how intense it got and how quickly it happened, you know, like, yeah. Which is how it's designed. You know, you're not going to know what that's going to be like. So yeah, that was difficult. And I remember like thinking the first day, like, there is no way they're going to pick me up. I look like I am not in shape at all. So, you know, that was definitely a tough moment. I bounced back, obviously, and because I'm here. But, and then I would say, you know, the water stuff never bothered me, but dive school was tough just because it was just hard. And I remember doing one man comp, like when I did one man competency, when I was done with that, I was like, that was one of the most challenging things I've done. And I was like, I don't even remember getting to the end.
Multiple times.
Yeah, I don't even remember finishing it. I just did, and I was done. I had oxygen again, and I was like, all right, I'm done. But yeah, I think I almost went to visit the wizard, as they say. But you know, I made it out. So
yeah, one man comp, man. I failed at the first two evolutions. And for our regular listeners out there, you've heard me talk about this, but you have three hacks at one man comp. So if you fail it the first time, you get a second shot, and it's conducted on a Friday. And if you fail your second shot, then you got to wait all the way until Monday until you get to do it again. And if and when you pass it, then you got to do two man comp, which not a lot of people fail. I don't remember anyone that failed two man comp, but one man comp is tough. If you want more information about it, check some of our previous podcasts to get info on one man comp. So you crush one man comp eventually, Chris, and you moved on. Anything else in the pipeline that was really challenging? What about combat control school, the infamous 12 mile ruck? What about that?
Yeah. So I don't think that physically some of the stuff in the pipeline wasn't the most challenging for me. The 12 mile definitely was no joke. The combat control school, none of the physical aspects were like something to not pay attention to and focus on. The thing that was difficult was like getting the combat control school. And, you know, it was hot, you know, like we went through and it was really hot in North Carolina. It is just hot here, hot and humid. And, you know, there's things that you learn, some lessons you got to learn the hard way, I think, as a Stowe especially. And I remember a moment on a tank trail ruck, which are not fun. And I had guys falling out all over the place because of dehydration. And, you know, it was something that I could have prevented because I just wasn't paying attention to what guys were eating at lunch and like making sure that they're focused on what the next training events are. And something that I was told to pay attention to because they said it was going to be hot. Like instructors gave us the warning. And so seeing guys go down for that was tough. Cause like, I was like that directly reflects on my leadership and, or failure of leadership in this situation. And that was harder for me than anything physical that was done. Cause you know, guys are legitimately at physical risk right there. So something bad could really happen to them. So that was one of the hardest things I think I remember whenever I look back at the pipeline.
And Chris, in aspects of leadership, can you tell our listeners some advice on what makes a good leader, especially in a tactical setting?
Yeah, I think generally a good leader is someone who's not really concerned about their own personal gain and their own personal progress or whatever, however you want to say it. Like, I've never been focused on my career and where it's going to go from like a rank progression or what positions I hold. I think if you're focused on, you know, your guys' success and progression and making sure they have what they need to do to get their job done and you knocking down barriers so they can do that, that's going to reflect positively on you because they're going to do amazing things because they're all just super talented guys. Like every one of them. Like I know plenty of guys who have multiple degrees and are world-class capable athletes. I mean, you've had a few of them on here. And so from a leadership perspective, like that's what I envision as servant leadership is you're there to put those barriers out of the way And, you know, like stuff that comes down from higher ranks and from different command echelons, like figuring out how to abate those requirements in a way that you can appease your bosses, but keep your guys focused on the task and what they've got to do, and not burden them with stuff they don't need to worry about. And then tactically, like the same thing kind of applies. If you're focused on the up and out and kind of shielding everybody from the stuff that doesn't need to pertain to the mission, and also keeping everyone vectored on the right, you know, path, you know, like making sure we're going the right direction and we're staying on the objective. Like we don't, you know, you got a lot of energy. You got to, yeah, exactly. You just got to keep everything like vectored in a way. And if you do that, like you don't really have to push too hard to get people to do what they need to do. Like this community of guys are going to be successful. Like they will, they've got all the thrust in the world. You just need to help keep them on focus and make sure that they understand like commander's intent, and you digest that in a way that you're meeting everybody's needs. You know, I think that's all it is.
Great advice, Chris. What about from a communication aspect? What is a good way to approach perhaps having to confront enlisted personnel?
Ooh, that's a broad question. I've always been under the belief that like, just have human conversations with people. You know, it doesn't need to be, like the rank structure always exists, in my opinion, and these guys recognize that, and they know that that's a thing. So you don't need to necessarily like worry about demanding some sort of respect or any of that type of stuff. Like I think just have human conversations with them. And I've always found that if you explain what it is you want to do or what is going wrong or what needs to be fixed or what they're doing right, and have those open and two-way dialogue conversations, like you'll never have issues communicating effectively with your guys and them feeling like you're always on their side. You know, I think that's all it is. So.
Well, you've been very clear about being a servant leader, as you mentioned earlier, and taking care of your guys. And that seems to have been your key to success. Great points there, Chris. Where did you end up getting stationed after you graduated the combat control / special tactics officer pipeline?
We got put up at the 22nd Special Tactics Squadron up in Tacoma, Washington. That's where we moved after Herbie. So.
That's a heck of a location up there, Joint Base Lewis-McChord. It doesn't get much better than that.
No, I loved it there. And if anyone gets a chance, if they come through all the pipeline and everything, like highly recommend it. It's a great spot.
So what was it like for you to finally get on your team and start doing the job?
It was good. I mean, I was looking forward to that. Intimidating, to be honest. You know,
like
you're coming out of the pipeline where you think you know something, but you don't. You just have enough knowledge and skill sets to be dangerous. And you're walking into rooms. This is the most humbling aspect of this job, I think, is you're walking into rooms where half the dudes have bronze stars, most of them with valor, a couple guys with silver stars, and have seen real combat and have done real things. And you've got to come in and step in and be a leader to those types of guys. That is not an easy thing to do very, you know, well. And I was in a unique position because I came in as a captain versus coming out of the pipeline as a lieutenant. So I was expected to like step up into the full-on team leader role, not really be an assistant team leader right away. So yeah, that was a unique experience, and I'm better for it. But yeah, I had to learn on the job a bit there and navigate those waters.
And I know I've been hitting you with some tough questions on the spot, Chris, but what do you think are some character traits and some signals in which somebody should consider going straight the commissioning route to go into the special tactics officer pipeline versus maybe enlisting as a combat controller first, seeing how that goes, and then maybe wanting to progress on their career? What are your thoughts?
Yeah. And you know, this is a question I answer a lot for people who are interested. I think what people need to really think about is what is it that they're looking to get out of special tactics or special warfare from the get-go. Like if your goal to come in and operate and do the mission and be the guy holding the radio and doing all those types of things, then I highly recommend you enlist first, because that's where you'll get that most experience. And it's awesome and it's very rewarding. But if you have a desire to lead, you'll get to do some of that as an officer, but it's very short and you might get one chance at it. And that's about it, because they need you for other things. So my recommendation is just really kind of make sure you've done some soul searching, understand what it is you're hoping to get out of it in your younger days of your career. And being an enlisted guy first, I mean, sometimes I wish I had done it. So it's not a bad way to go. And you can always switch over. And there's plenty of dudes I know that have crossed from enlisted to stow. And they're great stows, and they have a different experience, and they have a different perspective because they have the enlisted time. So yeah, that's how I would figure that out, I suppose.
Great. Thanks, Chris. And I know that you obviously can't talk a lot about your deployments and what exactly you did on those deployments, but you've been on a few deployments. Can you talk a little bit about a special tactics officer's role from a command and control aspect on a deployment?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, I would say the last deployment I did was to Iraq in some Syria time. In those experiences, you know, like I got to go out and do some of the missions. You know, I didn't get to do all of them, not even close. I wanted to, but I had guys, because I was in charge of our operations center as well. So like I had dudes that were assigned to SEAL teams and Army teams across multiple different locations. And I was their one of their singular links to make sure that they got the supplies that they needed. They got anything that they needed from host station done. I'm taking in their sit reps, kind of making sure that they're being taken care of by their own teams. And so me being on the mission is great, and I can do that. But I also have to make sure I'm balancing that with the fact that a lot of guys are counting on me to do other things that aren't necessarily related to the tactical aspects of that job. So that's kind of, it's kind of like you get to do a little bit of everything, you know, but your primary focus is taking care of the guy. So if a mission has to happen and the priority for me is going to be more guys are going out on other things and I need to be home to see that or back at the operations center to oversee those things, I have to put myself in that position versus out on the X or on the objective with other people doing things. Though that's hard and you won't want to do that because you're going to want to go on missions. That's your job and that's what those dudes are counting on you for. And that's where the servant portion of that comes in. You got to put their needs ahead of your own.
Well said, Chris. You're all about the team, big team player. And speaking of that, you actually right now are a part of a special program in which you are a part of the USA bobsled team, but are still an active duty Air Force member and still a special tactics officer. You got to tell us about that, man. That is absolutely incredible.
Yeah, I kind of found out about bobsled. Well, I knew about it for a while, but I decided to take a shot at it a couple years back, and I went through the tryout process, which involves like a combine, like some sprints and some jumping and stuff. It's similar to like football, no weights really right away. And then I made it through that process and started competing in 2019 because the Olympics were in 18 and I didn't go to those obviously. So went through that process, and then after I did some competitions, applied to the Air Force's world-class athlete program and got picked up for that. And so I had to wait for that to go through. I had another deployment that I went on with another unit and while I was training for bobsled. So that was, you know, that was unique, but that was good. I got a lot out of that one. And yeah, now I do that full time. I still kind of do some work with ST and, you know, that I've been keeping myself plugged into the community that way because I'm geolocated with some of those units right now. But yeah, for the most part, though, like focused on training and focused on the Olympics in 22 is what my objective is right now, is to try to make that team. So
incredible, Chris. Tell us about bobsledding. I don't know anything about it, and I didn't do research because I'm excited to hear about it from you for the first time. So tell us about bobsledding. Yeah. What it's all about. The competition. Okay. I heard you guys go up to like 90 miles an hour, man. What's that all about?
Yeah. So bobsled is, it's two different disciplines. There's a two-man event, which is a driver pulls the brakes at the end. And then there's a four-man competition, which is really, in my opinion, what bobsled is all about, where you've got three push athletes and a driver in the big sled. That's what you'll mostly see when you see pictures of it, because it's just cooler and faster. And yeah, so you know, there's the competitions that we do are all over the world, mostly Europe. I'd say that's where most of the tracks are. They bounce between France and Switzerland and Germany, Latvia. And then we have a couple of US and then there's Canadian based tracks is where most of the tracks live. And we go out and we compete against a lot of these other nations. And it's crazy because you come into a sport where there's a lot of returning Olympians and very capable athletes. And so, yeah, the positions on the four-man are really the most complex, I guess, of the different disciplines. You've got the driver in the front. He's the first guy to load and when we're pushing it down the ramp. And obviously, he does the driving. That's important because that's really where you win and lose the race. And then you got the three guys in the back, and they load left, right, and then the rear. And that's all coordinated at a full sprint going, you know, 20 miles an hour down the ramp. With, you know, and you're wearing these ice shoes, and it's, you know, you got a motorcycle helmet on and spandex, and it's just like, it's a pretty wild ride. And from there, you're just cruising. And you go, I mean, 90 is the max speed, I think, at one of the tracks. Wow. Most of the time, it's in the 80s. But yeah.
Incredible. And what would be your position on the team, Chris? What are some of the positions that you've done?
I've done two-man where I've been just a solo guy in the back. Most of the time, though, my position is left or right side on the four-man sled, and that's where I push from. So it all depends on – there's a bunch of different things that go into making up a crew between speed and power and weight and which guys are the best at those things and where they want to position guys on a team. So there's a lot of, like, technical aspects to bobsled. Like, there's a maximum amount of weight you can have in the sled, and there's a maximum amount of weight the sled and the riders can be to kind of even the playing field, because you could game it a lot with the technology. So there's a lot of rules on how that works. So we have to manage that through the weight of the athletes and how much weight we put in or take out of those sleds.
So there's a ton of teamwork involved in this.
Absolutely.
So tell us a little bit about bobsledding in a competitive perspective. How is it scored? Is it a time thing? Like, the fastest that gets down the same track wins? Pretty simple.
Yeah. I mean, that's all it is. It's a time trial. And so I'd say, like, the thing that's crazy about it is it's every race is won and lost within hundreds of seconds. I've won races and lost races by a hundredth of a second. That's just how tight the margins are. And so just best time, best combined time, because you do two different runs, two heats, and best combined time or lowest combined time will be first place, and from there you go back through the positions. The margins are small, and all that comes down to push start, because the push is important. That's where you get all your velocity, and then the driver has to do his job and not crash. One, I've done that. That's not fun. And not hit a lot of walls, or, you know, just not drive it too. Actually, you got to drive the least you drive, the faster you go. It's kind of a weird concept, but that's how it works. So,
and when it comes to you going to the 2022 Olympics, what are they looking for out of you guys as athletes? Like, what do you need to do to get there?
Well, it's a combination of things. Obviously, like, your athletic prowess and how well you would do as a pusher is important. Like, we do individual push competitions where you push a mock bobsled by yourself. And those times are critical to, like, where you place in the team and how they make up the crews. And then results as a team are important, how you guys do that season. And then obviously, like, who you are as a person and your teamwork is important, because it's a very team-based sport. So you have to be a good team player, because there's a lot of stuff that happens behind the scenes that people don't realize. Like, it's a blue-collar sport. All the work on the sled, all the transportation and movement of those sleds, which are, you know, very heavy, and there's a lot of technology in them. That's all done by the athletes. There's not some, like, magical pit crew behind us. We have a few guys that are, like, the mechanics, but for the most part, all that work's done by athletes. So you're not, like, that days are long, because you're mostly working on the sled, and we'll do all this training and all that stuff for 5 seconds of pushing and a minute long run. So it's a bit of a grind when all that's done in conjunction. So
Chris, is this something that you're going to be doing long-term, being in the Air Force, competing as at least kind of a pro athlete, for lack of better words, while still being a special tactics officer? Or do you have other plans or a different vision for your future?
Yeah. I mean, the program is designed in a way that you're allowed in so many years before the Olympic Games. And then once the Olympics take place, whether or not you make that team, you have to leave the program and go back to your career field. So my anticipation is I will leave bobsledding. I won't be old, but in the athlete world, I'll be, you know, my late 30s.
Yeah, so I understand.
Oldish in that world.
I mean, I had to walk on the U of A football team as a 26-year-old man. They called me Grandpa Sweet while I was on the team. So me both. I get it.
Yeah. I'm 30 years old or 33 now. And I'm, like, one of the oldest guys on the team. So you age quickly in the sports world, as you know. But yeah, after that, I'll go back to special tactics, and I will more than likely take a operations position, or maybe I'll be up for command at that point. I don't know what's going to happen. It's out of my hands.
Well, great, Chris. Thank you for your time tonight, man. I really appreciate you coming on with us tonight. Is there any last minute advice that you would give our listeners that are pursuing a career field like yours or pursuing somewhat of a similar life as yours as a high level athlete or a high level operator?
Yeah, I think the thing that's important that I always have to remind myself is like, there's going to be lots of setbacks, more failures than there are successes. I would say I've failed a million times more than I've been successful, and that's going to continue to happen. It's important to remember that that's important. Like, you need those things to grow, and how you respond to that stuff is going to be what defines you and defines your success down the road, of if it's going to come or if it's not. So you just got to be willing to roll with the punches and don't quit. Just don't ever quit. You know, I think that's thing you're going to hear in the pipeline a lot, but you can't quit. You got to keep moving. You got to keep moving forward, and you got to stay focused on your end state and your goal and the why of what you're doing. Cause there are going to be days where you're like, why am I doing this? I'm hurt. I'm beat up, you know, and things aren't going my way right now, but you've got to hold on to those things. Cause that's what's going to get you through the dark times. And have fun. It's got to be fun. If you're not having fun, it's probably not worth your time. You should probably figure something else out. So definitely have fun throughout the whole process.
Well said, Chris. For our listeners, I just posted up the Special Operators versus Elite Athletes podcast, as well as a podcast that I didn't tell you guys, with a good friend of mine, Vern Patterson, who is a soft tag P that has some really cool stories from the operational aspect and a day-to-day of a tag P. We don't really focus on pipeline stuff. We talk about mission stuff. So without further ado, let's get on to our first question. And that is going to be from Marcus.
When operating downrange, what's necessarily the difference in responsibility and mission capabilities of being an officer versus that of being enlisted?
A good question. So I think one of the things that you got to remember as taking on the job of a STO or any special operations force officer, if you're a SEAL officer, you're an 18 alpha, like the expectations are pretty same and similar across the board. Your job is obviously like, you're looking at it from more of a command and control perspective in the sense that you're keeping an eye on, you know, what is it, what's the mission that you have to do? Where are all your people? Are you on time? Like it's, Are you meeting the objective that you need to have? Are you talking to, we call it higher, but you making sure you're doing sit reps and stuff with headquarters? So you more have an up and out perspective, I guess, on what's going on. The easiest analogy I think that I like to use is like, if you were stacked up on a door, like you're not gonna breach the door and kick in the door and be the first guy in the door. That's not your job as an officer at all. Like that's not the expectation. You're going to go in that door at some point, but you may, you know, may go in just to hold a room and or move up to the roof so you can talk to the rest of your team and all that stuff. So you have to keep a broad perspective on what's going on the battlefield and understand all of those moving pieces and make sure that they're coordinated and, you know, keeping kind of keeping the big picture and not worried about like, you know, did that guy get checked to make sure that he's, you know, he doesn't have a grenade under him, or, you know, like the little details that like, that's what the enlisted force is good at. And that's what they're there to do. And I'm using very specific examples because they're easy to highlight and not necessarily accurate, but I think that's an easy way to kind of like visualize it, I guess, if that answers your question.
Great question, Marcus. Next question, Staff Sergeant Stebby, go ahead. Something about leadership in combat environments, I believe.
Yes, sir. Hey, Sergeant Stebby, I'm here at headquarters AFSOC. My question for you is, so leadership in a combat environment, what are some of the base characteristics you have, and then how do you build upon those? And then how would you like other STOs as well, or other special warfare officers, what kind of characteristics would you like them to have?
Yeah, so I'd say like the same characteristics that are going to get you into selection and get you, make you be successful through STO selection and through the pipeline are the same ones you're going to need to carry onto the battlefield. And that's going to be, you know, the simple stuff. It's all simple stuff at the end of the day. Like it's going to be integrity, being a servant leader, and being a kind of a selfless person in those scenarios, because that's what's going to be needed to be successful. And you have to be, you know, you have to be an intelligent dude, I think. Like you got to be able to comprehend a lot of different things at a lot of different levels and the impacts of decisions that you can make on the battlefield and what those can mean, not only at a tactical level, but there are things that happen on the battlefield that can have international repercussions and that's stuff that you don't necessarily count on the enlisted force to think about all the time. Though they will, you have to be thinking like, hey, if I drop a bomb on that, or I tell someone to drop a bomb on that thing over there, is that going to end up on the news tomorrow night in a bad way? And is that important? Is that okay? Or, you know, you got to be able to think through those types of things at those levels. So yeah, that's like quick and dirty on it. I mean, we could probably talk on hours about characteristics on what makes you successful, but those are the things I think I've seen from Stowe's that I've seen to be successful and that I admire, and that you know, that will get you through the pipe and through successful deployments.
Great question. All right, next question. We got Diego Chacon.
So my question was on the recruiting side of things. It seems like the enlisted side, it's pretty clear how that goes. I reached out to a line officer recruiter. So I'm prior service Air Force, currently in the Air National Guard, but I did some time on active duty. I don't have I'm going to bring this up because I feel like it could help other people in here that are thinking about applying. But on the off chance that anybody else has had any kind of negative information in the records, I don't have a criminal record at all. Never even really had one driving ticket, but I did get in trouble on the military side of things. And when I talked to the line officer recruiter, he said it didn't disqualify me, but they had so many people applying to become officers that, you know, he really didn't have time to try to put in a waiver or do anything like that, which I understood. I mean, I know officers are expected to be, you know, excellent and things like that. But he did kind of say, hey, why don't you check out the guard? And I don't think his mindset was with special warfare specifically. And I'm not trying to imply that, hey, maybe they would take me and the other officers a bit more excellent or anything like that. That's not what I'm saying, but I'm just wondering what advice you would give to somebody who's kind of been given that guidance, because I don't necessarily think on the officer side of the house, special warfare is plugged in at the recruiter level.
Yeah, so I think there's a few things going on there. To go through the whole Stowe selection process, I don't know, and this is probably just because I haven't been at that dealing with Stowe selection a lot recently, but I don't know if we're taking dudes directly off the streets to go through Stowe selection. Being that you're prior service, I think you can still go to Stowe selection even as an enlisted member without having gone to OTS. I have seen that happen in the past. Don't think that you couldn't apply to Stowe selection, and I'm not telling you can for sure, so I don't want to eat my own words here, but I've seen that happen. So there's potential that that's a route you could go and then follow up with getting into OTS. The OTS selection and how that happens is a process that I am not in any way familiar enough to give you like accurate guidance on. I do know, and I have heard, that they are loaded with applicants. So I don't know if we have a special warfare aspect of that. I can reach out and push some information to Jason to disseminate to you guys about that specific topic and if that's something, an avenue that they have. But unfortunately, I don't have a really good answer for you. With concrete details, but hopefully that gives you something to use.
Great question, Diego. Go ahead, Vinny.
Hey, Chris. So it seems like the difference between someone who wants to go enlisted versus officer is really like an obsession or a passion with leading and being there to serve the other guys on your team first, and then doing the kind of cool operating stuff second. So I was just wondering what happened in your life that gave you, you know, some solid cues that you were even capable of leading guys versus needing to be led, if that makes sense?
Yeah, so I don't know. I mean, I don't know if I was at any point in my life where I was like, I'm going to be a leader and I want to be that as an officer. I think I always liked the idea of being the guy in charge of a command or a tactical element. I just always thought that was interesting, and having that responsibility was something I found interesting. The job, doing the job, is awesome. And so we talked about it a little bit on the podcast, but I would say, like, if your desire is to come in and operate and you want that experience, man, that's great. And go be enlisted and do that. You can always cross over to the officer side and get the best of both worlds. So just because you don't know that that's what you want right away, that's okay. And so I would behoove people, or I would implore people to go look at that option. It's like, hey, if you want that enlisted experience, that's a great thing to have. And I know a lot of guys, good friends, that have done that and crossed over and they're successful stows. It gives you a very different perspective. But I think I just always knew, like, hey, I was going to go to college and I wanted to, you know, lead at some point. And it's something I had to learn. Like, it wasn't like that inherent. It's not like I wouldn't say I was very good at this. I don't even know if I'm still good at it. You know, that's not my decision. I don't get to make that determination. My guys do. So I think that's something you kind of learn as you go. Like, I obviously came into being a stow wanting to do the operator stuff too. Like, if anyone doesn't say that's what they want to do, I think they're lying to you. Like, everybody wants to do the cool guy stuff. It's awesome. It's fun. But the aspect of like taking care of people and helping them through things and shielding them from things they don't need to worry about is something that I respect more and more and more the longer I've been a stow. And I really see the value of what that can bring. And when people have that mentality, that is what is going to make the whole community successful. So probably too long-winded, but hopefully that gets to your point or your question.
That was great, Chris. And I know you guys didn't hear our interview, and you'll obviously be able to listen to it on the podcast whenever it's posted, but you can tell that Chris early on in his life had values instilled in him where he was beginning to be a selfless individual, and he was concerned with empowering others and strengthening others. And you could see that throughout Chris's life, those character traits were developed. And so maybe he didn't know earlier on in his life that he was a leader, but he did have those traits, but those traits needed to be developed. So great question, guys. All right, next question. We got Kevin. Go ahead.
Thanks, Jason. Hey, Major. Sergeant Walker, Eglin Air Force Base. My question is a real quick one. Now that the Special Tactics Officers, Crows, all that have been combined to 19 Zulus, do you think that they're going to do a kind of a vectoring the same as the enlisted guys now going through the pipeline?
You know, I would say yes. I don't know enough about like the future plans right now on how they're going to continue Crow selection and Stow selection and ALO selection. Like, is that's going to be continue to be its own thing, or they're going to combine that into, I know like the big grand scheme concept here is that everything is combined into a singular selection process. And then from there, you know, you get to decide where you want to go. Will they vector guys to do certain things? Possibly. I don't have a good enough answer on that. Again, that's a question I used to work with the guy who runs recruiting, and I've worked for the colonel who is now in charge of special warfare for us. So that's stuff I can get answers to. I don't want to sit here and tell you something that's entirely wrong, but what I know and what I know of the vision for that program and the 19 Zulu effort is to probably head down that road. Is it there right now? No, I think things are still the way it was when I came in. There's been some title changes and we have the 19 Zulu as like an umbrella term, but from what I'm tracking, we're still doing the stuff the same way with stow selection, phase 2, phase 1 processes. And then from there going through the pipeline as I knew it. And again, all those things are things that are being evaluated currently. So I will push some of that info to Jason I'll try to get some of these questions with more fidelity for things like that. But I'm not so connected to that piece of like what the ST world is doing or special warfare world is doing that I could give you the most educated answer in the world. But yeah, hopefully that helps.
And Kevin, SOCOM Athlete will do our best to push out and be proactive about providing you guys with that information, but it's not always wise to give the play-by-play per se whenever there's a lot of dynamics and moving pieces. Sometimes it's better to sit back and just take care of your business and then wait on those changes to take place. Does that make sense?
It does. Thanks, Jason.
All right. Great question. Next question. Go ahead, Dean.
My question was originally more about the pipeline, but I came up with another one, so I'll ask that one. I guess coming in as being an officer without like having any prior enlisted experience, what kind of opportunities do you think you missed out on by not going in enlisted first?
I mean, obviously, you know, the thing that's still cool about the officer versus enlisted thing is one of the things that drew me to the career field, coming from maintenance, because that's what I did first as a maintenance officer, aircraft maintenance, was I didn't get to learn aircraft maintenance when I was an aircraft maintenance officer. Like, I didn't know anything about fixing airplanes. That wasn't my job. I learned about managing people fixing airplanes, and I didn't like that aspect of it. Like, I wanted to know the things the dudes I was in charge of knew and experience what they experienced. That is something you will get to do as a stow, even if you don't go the enlisted route first. So you will still go through that pipeline. You will still get smoked. You will still almost drown. You will still do all the things that suck and go to Halo and do all the cool guy stuff. You're just not going to do it as much at the end of the day, right? So the difference is, like, if you want years of going on deployments and being a JTAC and doing that type of stuff, or combat control team, or global access team, like, you'll get to do that more in the enlisted world. You get more reps, I guess, is really the end of the day. But you're not, like, you're as an officer, you're never going to do it. You're just not going to do it as much for as long, because they're going to need you to do other things. Like, there's not a whole lot of STOs. I mean, I think I know every single one of them, almost every one of them. There's like 100 of us, which isn't a huge amount of guys. So that's really the big difference there. I'm not going to oversell it and say, yeah, you're going to go out there and drop bombs and everything that moves and get to do exactly what the enlisted force does, because it's not entirely accurate. But it's not like you're not going to get to do everything either. So it's just different volumes and different focuses, because you still have to come home and take care of their performance reports and make sure that, like, the guy who had a baby is doing well. And, you know, you've got other responsibilities that aren't all based on, like, you know, the tactical aspect. So hopefully that answers your question.
Great question, Dean. Okay, let's go ahead and move on to Justin.
Hey guys, thank you for your time. My question was, in the world of CCT and on an STS, what are the roles and responsibilities of an NCO versus an STO?
So, like, the NCO, and any good officer, I think, will tell you that, and I'm not saying I'm a good officer, I don't say that as a prerequisite, but anyone who knows what they're talking about is going to say, like, hey, your NCOs are the guys you're going to lean on the most, because they should have the most knowledge of, like, the technical aspects of your job, right? Like, if I had a question about, you know, anything about a survey or which bomb to use on a certain target, like, in weaponeering types of questions, like, I would ask my NCOs, because they should know that. That's what they're in the books on. So I would say, like, they're technical experts. What I'm supposed to know as a STO is I need to understand what it is we're doing, as, like, what's the purpose of this mission? How does that meet the intent of my commander? How does that meet the intent of his commander? And how does that meet the national objectives of the United States and of the military, right? So you got to understand a lot of layers of things that you don't need to know if you're just worried about how to blow up buildings really well, you know, or how to survey a runway faster, or how to do a hey-ho jump. You have to be familiar as a STO of those things, but it's unrealistic to expect everyone to know all that stuff, obviously, from both sides. So I would say that, like, your NCOs are your technical experts, and they're the ones that are going to be, like, helping get all the guys below them going on and focused on the same direction. So when it comes to, like, command and control and leadership, you're going to pass your intent down to your NCOs and say, hey, this is what we need to get done, and this is how we got to do it. And you're going to let them run with it, right? And they're going to come up with the best solution, and you're just going to be there to let them make sure that's still meeting your intent. That's how it should work. Because you don't want to be the guy that's dictating every movement. You're micromanaging, and it's not effective. So I would say that's, like, the quickest way to explain it, though that's, you know, its own topic by itself. Yeah.
And for our listeners out there, when they say NCO, that's non-commissioned officer. Obviously, many of our listeners are active duty or prior service, but many of you are civilians and you don't necessarily know these acronyms. So non-commissioned officer refers to, in the Air Force in particular, when you put on E5, which is a pay grade that is staff sergeant. So your non-commissioned officers are your staff sergeants, your technical sergeants, your master sergeants, senior master sergeants, and chief master sergeants. So when they're talking about NCOs and discussion and communication and how you interact with NCOs, they're talking about enlisted communication and enlisted interaction versus the officer, right? So, okay, next question. Go ahead, Staff Sergeant Stebby.
Hey, sir, me again. All right, so my second question is going to be, so as a major, knowing what you know now, sorry for the kids in the back, as a major, knowing what you know now, what is some advice you would have for the lieutenant version of yourself as far as growth or what you should expect for the future?
I think the thing that I would always go and tell young officers, and especially if I could go back and tell myself, is, like, enjoy everything that you're going to go through and do. Like, understand that it's going to be shorter than you realize. Like, you know, the pipeline and your time on a team and doing all that stuff is, like, precious, and you don't get a lot of opportunity to do it. And it's the best portion of a STO's job, one of the best portions of it. I would tell myself, like, hey, enjoy the whole process, even when it sucks. Like, those are memories that you're going to hold on to forever. And you're gonna cherish that time you spent with those guys, and it's gonna not come back. You don't get to go do it again. So that's really the big thing. Like, obviously care about your people, like always take care of them, and everything else will take care of itself. Like, I think we talked about it in the podcast, but if you're worried about the mission and making sure that the mission happens, and then you're worried about the guys, the men, and then worry about yourself at the end of the day, and you'll be fine. And that actually is a reference to a book by a guy named Pete Blaber, who used to be a Delta commander, The Mission, the Men, and Me, which I would say is my hands down favorite leadership book. So if you guys are out there looking for like someone who's really articulated it well, I think that's who I would read that. But that's how I've tried to, follow when I've looked at my career, and I would make sure to reemphasize that to myself and to the young guys.
All right. Next question. Go ahead, Dean.
You mentioned earlier about like reps for, officer counterparts. I've heard some conflicting things throughout my career. Is that like your reps stop at like 4 years once you reach captain, or is it all dependent on your base? What would you say like is the, I guess, the truth?
All right. So I will say, like, just imagine it's going to be less than you hope it will be. That's all. That's the best way I can put it. Like, you're never going to feel like you got to do enough. But with that, I think there's some maturity that will come as you go through that process, and you'll realize, like, hey, the impact that you can have, though, like, I'm a guy who wants to be out on the X doing things. Like, I've always been that way. Like, I'm an athlete, and I have those skill sets, and I think I can be successful at it. But I also realize, like, if you care about the dudes and you are worried about their success, like, the impact you can have is going to be much bigger, because you can help them, and there's more of them than there are of you. There's more of a team, you know, it's a team thing. So you get the team moving along and get them on the same path and, you know, move obstacles so they can finish the mission. The mission's going to happen better. It's just, you're going to have to step back and realize, like, you're not going to necessarily be the guy that got to make all the calls and give the cleared hots and, you know, do the air traffic control and all that stuff. It's just the way it is. But to like get down to numbers, I can't give you a hard and fast rule, but I would say, like, when you put on major, more than likely your time as an operator, like true operator, is pretty much done. There are some special places you can go to continue potentially, but it's not a discussion we can have here, but it's out there. It's something you can look into when you get in the world. But yeah, I'd say lieutenant to captain is where you're going to have your best bang for your buck in terms of, hey, you're going to get to do the jump trips and all that stuff. As long as you're on team, once you get off team, you can still squeeze it in from time to time, but it's definitely not as frequent. So that's the quickest way. I hope that explains it. But there's no like hard and fast rule. Like, I've known majors that have gotten to do JTAC rotations, right? It's happened, but it's rare, and especially in today's environment. Something I think that needs to be reiterated with everybody is, like, you have to take a look at what's going on in the world and realize, even in the enlisted world, like, the amount of kinetic operations that are happening and bombs that are getting dropped and missions that are being run, it's reducing across the entire special operations command. So special forces teams, SEAL teams, like, everyone isn't seeing the same amount of volume as they have in the past. Just something to recognize. Does that mean you shouldn't do it? Absolutely not. But just realize, like, the operating environment has changed, and it's not 2005 anymore. And, you know, it's just a different world, and that will change again. Like, it goes through cycles, unfortunately, but yeah.
Well said, Chris. Well said. Thank you for that wisdom. Thank you for that answer. Okay, gentlemen, next question is Joseph. Go ahead, my man.
Hi, Chris. Thank you for giving your time to us today. I have a question about like AFSOC's 2030 and 2020 vision, and how you're experiencing it and how you see that playing out as teams begin to, I suppose they've become more of a conglomerate of a special tactics team. Any insight you can give is great. Thank you.
Whew, that's a very specific question. You know, as that vision kind of came out, I transitioned to a new unit. So I don't know if I have the best answer for it. I think it's a long-term vision, right? So I don't think we're quite there yet. And I think because of the changes in the operating environment that we're seeing, like, our efforts as an ST and special warfare community to change our role a little bit, and how we can be a better force multiplier and a better supporter in the world of AFSOC and the world of SOCOM. I think as we go through that process, we're probably not making the headway that we want to make, to be honest, just because things aren't moving as fast as anyone wants them to, but that's how visions go, I believe. But I think what we're trying to do is righteous, because the whole objective of it is to keep us employed and keep the team employed and use the talent that we have in the most effective way that can not only help ourselves, but help the United States Air Force, help the U.S. and our national objectives. So it's a kind of a generic answer. I don't have really good specifics for you, but yeah, hopefully that niece, you know, hits it a little bit on the head of what you want, but please ask some more if that doesn't quite get what you're looking for.
Well, Joseph, part of this AFSOC vision, you have to keep in mind that AFSOC has divvied out combat controllers and pararescuemen for a very long time onto other soft teams. And obviously we're one big team, right? We realize that, but the Air Force can't help but wondering what it would be like if we could do our own mission as part of a unilateral force. So keep that in mind. It is a justified mission, but it will take some time to get there. If we do get there, and when we do get there, it will take a lot.
Okay. I'm just going to jump in again, because it's just one of those things that's, there's been a way things have been done for a long time in the special operations community, right? Like what ODAs do, what SEAL teams do, and the idea of unilateral, all those types of terms bring certain connotations with them. And with that brings a bit of a parochial view on how things should work. So you got to understand, like, what we're trying to do is a little unique and different, and the vision is aspirational in the eyes of other service branches. And so that's going to create a little bit of an upstream swim, I guess, is the best way to put it. So I don't know if that helps, you know.
Yeah, I agree with you, Chris. That's very well said. I think we're on the same mindset there. So good question, Joseph. Okay, next question. Damar, go ahead, my man. And Damar, you're new to the program, correct?
Yes, sir. I am new.
Great. And you're talking to us from Alabama, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, Tuscaloosa, Alabama.
Great. How have you enjoyed the group so far?
Great. It's definitely one of the best resources I've found, and I appreciate all you guys do to help aspiring, you know, SOF people.
And Damar, you're in the military right now, is that correct?
No, I'm not. I just graduated from college this semester.
Just graduated from college. Congratulations, my man. What career field are you training for?
Pararescue. I'm hoping to get into PJ with the Kentucky Air National Guard for the 123rd.
Understood. That's a great unit. Great unit. 123rd Special Tactics Squadron for our listeners out there. That's in Kentucky, Louisville, Kentucky. All right, yes. Damar, go ahead, man. Great to have you here, by the way. I'm glad you're a part of the program. Go ahead and ask your question.
Thank you. I just want to say thank you to you, Jason, and thank you to Chris, both you guys, for your time. My question was, you know, as I said, I just graduated from college this semester. And whenever I tell people my next step is to enlist, they automatically ask why I don't commission instead, you know. Because on the civilian side, it's like automatically, oh, everybody should want to be an officer. But to truncate my answer, I normally say I want to do the job as opposed to planning or leading the job. And I was wondering if the difference between enlisted and commissioned is actually that cut and dry when you're downrange.
Great question, man. What do you think, Chris?
Yeah, so, I mean, congrats on graduating. I'm sorry if you didn't get to have a ceremony. That's a momentous occasion in your life, and I know this COVID thing is throwing a bunch of people's lives into chaos, so hopefully you got to celebrate somehow. But to answer your question, we kind of discussed it earlier before. I don't know if you heard the other answers, but yeah, I would say it comes down to what it is you want to do. So if like your goal is to come and become the most technically savvy operator you can be and be very good at the technical aspects of that job, then the enlisted force is the direction you're going to want to go. You're going to get to do and learn all those things as an officer. I can't speak to the crow side as well because I didn't do that. And I know that their training pipeline is different than what PJs do at some points. That at the end of the day, like they didn't hire you because of how good you will be as a technical operator. They're hiring you to be an officer or a stow or a crow because of your leadership qualities and what you can bring to that portion of mission success. So you'll get to do it. You won't do it as much. But if you want to have the experience as an operator for as long as possible, the enlisted side is going to be where it's at. But realize, even the enlisted force, eventually, they all go into a command and control role. Even like your senior NCOs, like their role changes somewhat too. They're not always, you know, getting to do the job as much as they want to. Granted, by that time, most of their bodies are pretty old and broken, but, you know, I would say that if that's what your goal is, that's a good way to start. And if you, in that process, you find that, hey, like leadership is something that's my calling and I want to do that, and you can always cross over. Like, that's always an option. So, yeah, hopefully that answers your question.
All right. Great question, Damar. Mr. Welker, go ahead, my friend.
Thanks, Jason. Hey, Major. Once more, you've noticed or you've mentioned that, you know, the Stowe doesn't normally knock down doors or go train with the guys every day. So what is the average workday life in the day of a Stowe?
All right. So the best way to put it, when you're a team leader, because that's going to be your tactical time, as we call it, you're going to go on every training trip that you want to go on. You can absolutely go do all the events and be involved with that. The problem is you are going to plan every training trip that you go on, right? So that's what comes with it. So you're going to be doing logistics. Your team's going to be helping out with that stuff. Like, it's not all on you. But your job is to be the logistics, the coordinator, all that type of stuff, and make sure that, hey, you're briefing to the commander what it is you want to do. You're doing risk management stuff, because that is part of your job, is to look at, hey, do we want to jump out at 30,000 feet and do a, you know, 10K offset hey-ho into this unmarked DZ? Okay, that's cool. What's the point of that? Is it meeting one of your objectives for what you're going to do downrange? And have you mitigated the risks accordingly? Is your team ready to do that type of training? And so that's your job, is to like look at those things critically and say, okay, yeah, we can do that, but maybe we need to do some other training first to get there. And then you're going to have all the paperwork stuff. Like, that's just part of being an op. Everyone has paperwork. It's not just officers, but you have more. And
fellas, I got to interrupt real quick. As an enlisted guy, I can tell you that enlisted guys, they're going to want to do as much cool, hardcore, dangerous stuff as possible. And there has to be somebody that puts that in check and says, okay, how are we going to do it? How is it going to be accomplished? What's going to be the benefit of it? And what's the risk? And then, of course, how are we going to put it all together? So again, you know, you really are that supervisor of the overall picture. So anyway, back to you, Chris.
Yeah, Jason nailed it on the head. That's exactly right. The guys are going to want to go 1,000 miles an hour, which is great, and you want that, but you also have to be a little bit of the brakes in there, or at least know, hey, this meets the intent of what it is we're trying to do. And because you're at the end of the day, you want to keep them safe. That's the most important thing, because they have to get to the objective to even accomplish the mission, right? So you have to make sure that the training is not more dangerous than the mission, because that doesn't make any sense at all. And you also have to make sure that the boss, your boss and his boss, are okay with what you're doing, and that they can buy into it. And you're going to have to, there's a little bit of salesmanship, which is easily mitigated by you doing your due diligence and making sure that you're taking care of your team and you're looking out for their best interests and their safety.
Thanks for that. Seems like a bunch of 25-hour days you got going on.
It ebbs and flows, like anything. Like, there will be long days, but everyone has them. It's not just, like, your days will be long sometimes. Sometimes it won't be. It all depends. But, yeah, there will be days where you'll go out on the range all day and shoot and have a great time and then be like, oh, man, I have to come back and work on OPRs or EPRs or, you know, there's, you know, travel vouchers. There's all sorts of stuff, but that's, you know, that's just part of the job. So,
all right, Vinny, go ahead.
Thanks, Jason. This one just popped up for me, Chris. I know a lot of us are very excited about, you know, joining the Air Force and chasing after these roles, but what are some of the negatives of the role that you've experienced, or guys that you manage have experienced, that we, you know, might be overlooking in our enthusiasm, whether that's long-term effects or, you know, day-to-day minor stuff that's irritating? Like, what are some of the negatives that we should be aware of?
Yeah, so there is no job, I think, in the world that doesn't have downsides. Like, it's just everything has to have some balance to it, right? So I would say, you know, there's going to be a lot of time away, even when you're not deploying. Like, I remember training cycles sometimes being as much as 200 TDY days a year. Like, it can be that busy. Good thing is, as an officer, you can control that tempo, and that will be something that's expected of you. But there's going to be a lot of time away, just the way it is. Like, when I was stationed at the 22 STS, we didn't have any live fire at close air support ranges, meaning we couldn't drop any real bombs anywhere. We couldn't even drop fake bombs in most places. And part of being a JTAC is you have to drop a bomb for real. So there's a lot of TUI just to keep guys current on certain skills. So just because of location, there's things that you're just going to have to travel to do to keep your team up to speed. So that's a downside for sure. Sometimes, I mean, it could be slow. I don't know if some people's expectations is they're going to come in and there's just deployment after deployment and there's tons of stuff to do down range. Right now, I would say that's not the way it is. So that could be looked as a negative and it might be a bit of an underwhelming experience if that's what your expectation is at the moment. And other than that, I don't know. I don't have like things that jump out at me that I would say are the worst things about it. It's like any other job in some ways that there are things that are going to wear on you and the paperwork will become a bit cumbersome and, you know, that can happen. But I think when you step back and luckily now that I've been removed of it being an athlete, like I look back and I'm like, man, the things that I was worried about were kind of, you know, small peanuts in the big scheme of things. Like I have a pretty cool job and that, you know, and I look at it from that perspective, I always know it's cool. So hopefully I answered your question. I'm sure there's some things I'm forgetting and things that if you go through it, you'll experience and be like, oh, you didn't tell me about this. But I hope that helps some.
That does. Thank you.
Great question, Vinny. All right. Next question. Go ahead, Marcus.
If one manages to get selected to be a spec war officer who is prior enlisted, how are they typically treated within the teams and the squadrons, and how does their prior experience being on the operating side affect being in the command climate instructor?
So, I mean, it depends. If you're a prior enlisted controller, very different than if you're just prior enlisted. Obviously, prior enlisted controllers, the thing that's tough, I think the hardest thing that they're going to have to do is a lot of the guys that they were buddies with and drinking beer with and going, you know, doing whatever, are now probably subordinates and at a different rank structure than they are. That's a tougher thing to navigate in a professional environment. That doesn't mean that they can't still remain friends, but it's just something that in the professional world, it's going to change how you interact a little bit. And that's something to be cognizant of. So that's unique. What the experience as a prior enlisted guy and what they have to do as a prior enlisted officer is that's unique. But I would say generally like guys who are prior enlisted have a lot of respect because they know, I mean, they've done all the things that they're asking these guys to do. They've experienced it from their eyes. So that's unique. That doesn't mean they have more respect than a regular STO. It all depends, 100% depends on how you are as an officer and how competent you are. Because while you might be their best friend when you were enlisted guy or they didn't know you because you just came out of college, if you're competent and you are caring about the right things and doing the things, like I said before, like the mission, the men and me, they're going to respect you and they're going to want to follow you and they're going to, you know, do their job well and make you look good. So that's really what it all comes down to, I think.
Another great question. All right, gentlemen, we're going to go ahead and wrap this up. Thank you, Chris, for coming on with us tonight and just sacrificing some of your time to empower the next up and coming generation of operators. We really appreciate it. If you enjoyed the podcast, please take some time to give us a 5-star review. Give us a follow on Instagram at SOCOM Athlete. Check out our brand new YouTube channel at SOCOM Athlete. This is your host, Jason Sweet. We are out.